What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of Fitz Dog Radio. And when I say special, I mean it's Fitz Dog Radio. It's always special, isn't it? For me, it is. 14 years in, I still enjoy it every week, except I missed, was it last week or the week before? I took a week off and I'm back. Maybe it was 2 weeks ago. But I have a great guest today, Adam Conover from Adam, what's it called? Adam hates everything. Adam ruins everything. You know that guy. I know the show. I used to watch it. Very excited he came in. He's a guy that I've been doing stand-up with a little bit lately. And anyway, he's here, or he was here. I interviewed him about 2 hours ago. And the podcast goes up tomorrow. Here's a couple random thoughts that I've been having. For instance, when I was a kid, I thought that they were saying Hi Hitler. Like, Hi Hitler. I didn't know it was Heil Hitler. I thought it was like a woman going like, Hi Hitler. Like, I wonder if Eva Braun was ever like, why is that woman saying Heil Hitler to you? She never says Heil Hitler to me. Why is she saying Heil Hitler to you? Is Heil Hitler more or less offensive than Hi Hitler? Because if you're saying Heil, you're kind of, it's Hail. You're saying Hail. So you're putting him up on a pedestal. But if you say Hi, that's almost more intimate. Like you are flirty, or if you're just very casual, like, hey, Mike. Hey, Hitler. Hi, Hitler. It's like when I was a kid, I thought we used to listen to the radio when I was a kid, and they would always announce on the news the stock market report, and the announcer would say, S&P 500 was up 60 shares today. And when I was a little kid, I thought he was saying chairs. And I thought the stock exchange was like a big dining room where people bought and sold stuff. And that if there weren't a lot of people there, they would take chairs out. So they would say it was up 60 chairs or down, say, whatever. No joke, just little things that I think about. What if I was one of those comedians? Here's some little things I think about. I mean, not that I'm saying anything important, but I'm certainly not that guy. Might go to Montreal this summer. I love it. I speak some French, and I enjoy strutting my French out, especially because Quebec is so much more understanding of a bad French speaker. If you go to France and you try to speak French with an English accent or American accent, they will not speak French to you. They will revert to their even worse English than your French is. They would rather have you not understand their shit English than for them to understand your bad French but not like it. How about that? So first of all, Quebec, I'm glad you are, but why are you speaking French? Does that not seem like a reminder of days gone by that were not so good? Like when the French colonized you and fucking there was genocide against the native people and the French government squoze you. I think the English did after that. First it was the French, then it was the English. Don't you think they'd be sick? Why be reminded of being colonized? You know, like if you're a woman and you divorce your Cuban husband because he was abusive and he took all your money, you wouldn't then speak Spanish. Like, assuming you're an English-speaking woman, would you speak Spanish after divorcing your abusive Cuban husband? And again, I'm not saying Cuban men are abusive. Desi Arnaz apparently was a little fucking, little heavy with the hand with Lucy once in a while. And the kids. Who knows? Who knows? Wasn't there a Desi Arnaz Jr.? There was, right? There's a Freddie Prinze Jr. Pretty sure there was a Desi Arnaz Jr. I think if you grew up named Desi in America, wouldn't you not, based on what you probably dealt with, would you not fucking name your kid Desi? I don't know. People shitting on you. You think you're a bad person. You internalize. That's how it is when you're a kid. People tease you for your name. You think it's you. I think somehow you're bad. I was thinking about like how we don't like people based on if they like us, which seems a little self-centered and a little egotistical. Like if you consider yourself a self-actualized, grounded person with confidence, why do you care if someone likes you or doesn't like you? If you like you, that should mean very little. Meanwhile, that's kind of what we base our feelings on. Like, hey, do you like Dave? Fuck that guy. That's what you'll say if you know that Dave doesn't like you. You'll say, fuck that guy. You know? Dave might be everything that you seek out in a friend. Or even just existing as a person, kind, generous, great athlete, good looking. But if he doesn't like you, fuck that guy. Why can't you just go, Dave's a great guy, doesn't like me? Like, there's a comedian that's like that. Most comics like me. There's one comic, he doesn't dislike me, but he ended our friendship by not calling me back many times. Not many. I sound like a fucking stalker, but I called him 3 or 4 times and he didn't answer. Got the hint. I got it. I don't dislike this guy at all. I think he's a really good dude. I think he's a funny comic, great podcaster. And it's not, don't start thinking who it is. It's not who you think it is because he's not that well known. But it's just like, I don't dislike him because I like me. I know that I'm a good person. If someone doesn't like me, it probably has to do with them. Like if I go to Chick-fil-A and the cashier is rude or dismissive, if she's dismissive of me, I don't say, fuck Chick-fil-A. I say, I'm going back to Chick-fil-A. This fucking juicy piece of chicken on this warm bun is making me happy. I respect their fucking hustle. I'm going back. Even if they treat me bad again, I'm going back. And I feel like that about Dave. Still going to hang out with Dave. If he doesn't want to talk to me, that's fine. I want to be in Dave's presence. I want to live in the glow of Dave. By the way, the guy's name's not Dave. Now you're thinking it's like Dave. Who's a Dave that has a podcast? Dave Anthony, I think, has a podcast. Anyway, it's like that. And then by the same token, you can think a guy is an asshole until he likes you a lot. Then he, you know what? I didn't like that guy, Bill. I always thought Bill was kind of an asshole. You know, he's fucking dirty. treats women poorly. He's fucking broke. He's always borrowing money. I never liked him. But you know what? Hung out with him the other night. He fucking loves me. I love him now. Now I love him because my self-esteem is so fucking low that somebody just liking me is all I care about. That's how fucking tentative my self-esteem is. That's all it, like Bill Maher shits on Trump relentlessly. And then he sits down with him for an hour. And now he's like, hey, he's a good guy. He's kind of charming. I like him. Anyway, all right. I'm not going to waste time. I'm going to get to the podcast. I did want to share a nice little email I got. This came from a couple that had seen. Well, here's the email sent to my site. If you ever want to email me, fitzdogradio@gmail.com. I get back to everybody. Might take a minute, but I always get back to people. Always wanted to share this story with you. 8 years ago at the Philadelphia Helium Comedy Club, I came to see you on a random Friday night. I went alone and sat up front. The woman sitting next to me went alone and sat up front as well. Halfway through your set, you told me to buy her a drink. Well, we just had triplets. Thank you for the best thing that ever happened to me. Holy shit. That's all it took was one drink for her to have sex with you and have triplets? This is an amazing story. This makes me so, I am so touched by this because I do sometimes try to get people to meet each other at my shows. A lot of people come alone to the shows and I respect people that come alone to a comedy show. I think it's awesome. And I'm so glad, I don't remember specifically, I have met them at Philly. They've come back to see me at Philly before, so I knew they were together. But I didn't know they had triplets. Congratulations. Sending all my love. And I hope that one of those three motherfuckers is named Greg. And the other one is named Desi. I got a friend named Keegan Cerf, who's a South African comedian that I met when I was in Cape Town at Christmas. I did a show with him. Very funny dude. Anyway, we were just texting. I just want to promote a show he's doing in Cape Town at the Baxter Theater. On August 30th, if you want to go down, tickets are, he said tickets are $120. I guess that's Rand. I think when we were there, Rand were about 14 Rand to the dollar. So that means this is like a $12 ticket. So come on, South Africa. I know they're committing genocide against the white people in South Africa. Maybe this will get you out of the gunfire of the genocide that's being committed against you white people in South Africa. Go check them out. Get tickets at Web Tickets. I'll be coming to you in Tampa at Side Splitters June 5th to the 7th. Sacramento, I'm opening up for Louis C.K. June 13th and 14th. Torrance, California at The End on June 29th. Austin, Texas, the Mothership, July 4th through the 6th. Pottstown, PA, Soul Joles, July 31st. Point Pleasant at Uncle Vinny's on August 1st and 2nd. La Jolla Comedy Store, August 29th through the 31st. Also got dates coming up in Denver, Connecticut, Vegas, Chicago. Go to fitzdog.com, get some tickets. Oh, also want to give a shout out to my buddy Frankie. He's got a coffee company that I think you'll love, Sleepy Hollow Coffee Roasters. He has been researching and practicing for years, and he just launched his line of roasts. He's got Katrina, which is a vibrant taste of fresh blueberries. There's Ichabod. Is that more of it? Ichabod's my favorite. It's a rich, dark, chocolatey taste. He sent me some samples. They're unbelievable. It's fresh roasted. Stop drinking coffee out of habit. Start experiencing it. Go to SleepyHollowCoffeeRoasters.com. By June 1st, that's this week, enter promo code FITZDOG at checkout. Get 15% off and check it out. Support my friend. He's a great dude. He's got a good product. SleepyHollowCoffeeRoasters.com, promo code FITZDOG. All right. Let's get to it. My guest today, you know him from his True TV show, Adam Ruins Everything. He's got a podcast called Factually. He hosted a show called The Crystal Maze. He had a show on Netflix called The G Word. Just great. We had such a great talk today. Went long. Hope you enjoy the full length of it. Here is my guest, Adam Conover. Adam Ruins Everything. That was his show.
Are we starting?
Yeah, we started. I mean, what am I going to give one of those intros? Like, my next guest starred in and created. You know, people know who you are. You're this fucking guy.
Hopefully, yeah. I'm a guy. I'm a very minor level of celebrity for people who were watching basic cable during the last days of basic cable. They're like, oh, the guy who used to come on after Impractical Jokers. I would fall asleep during Impractical Jokers, and then I would be awoken by a nasal voice, and that was me.
Yes, but True TV had not, it was a dying channel. And then seriously, like True TV, nobody even knew where it was.
Yeah.
And then Impractical Jokers, and you came along, and then they spun out a couple little shows like Dumb Criminals, like,
yeah,
comedians in boxes talking about dumb criminals.
They had been like a sort. They used to be Court TV, and then they were doing trashy reality stuff.
Yeah.
And then they got a new management, like a new president and people.
Yeah.
And their mandate was to compete with Comedy Central. And so they started having, they had Impractical Jokers, they had us, they had Michael Carbonara was a comedy magic show.
Right.
They had Hack My Life, which was Brooke Van Poppel and Kevin Pereira, two very funny people. A couple of other shows. Comedy Knockout, that was like an At Midnight.
I remember.
Knockoff.
I think I was on that. I was on that.
And they started to build up some steam.
Yep.
And then AT&T bought Time Warner and shut down the whole network.
Yes.
And fired literally 100 people.
Yes.
And those are just people, and then canceled every show, except for Impractical Jokers, which is now the only thing that airs.
Is it still called True TV?
There is. Does cable still exist?
I don't even know.
If you open cable and you scroll down, there's something called True TV.
Yeah.
And it runs Impractical Jokers on a loop until March when it plays NCAA games. And then it goes back to
Impractical
Jokers.
A lot of these little cable channels, they pop up Pluto or whatever, and they're like,
Pluto,
all right,
sure.
So we're going to get a show that we think is big enough and throw money into it that will bring people to our channel. All right. If you're that guy, you don't need a cable channel to do that. You just do what you do. You start a YouTube channel, and you get all the revenue with none of the overhead.
I wouldn't say you get all of the revenue. You get some revenue.
Well, you got to pay your crew.
Yeah, but you don't. Okay. So, yes, I am now doing what I do on YouTube because YouTube has kind of eaten most of television apart from like the high-end narrative scripted, right?
Yeah.
And so that's where I'm doing YouTube, podcast, et cetera. And I make about as good a living now as I did when I was a host on cable. But the amount of revenue is like a hundredth because, remember, that's just my part.
Right.
I'm making that amount. True TV used to make 100 times more than they paid me. Obviously,
yeah,
that's why the show was profitable because they sold ads against it at this really high ad rate, right?
Yeah.
But YouTube, the ads are so much cheaper, despite the fact people are still watching them on their televisions.
But then you do the Patreon as well, right?
I do the Patreon. Yeah, that's some extra money, but it's nice. Those are like my most committed fans, right?
Then you got your commercials.
We do the podcast ads, et cetera, and it all adds up to a living,
right?
But my point is, we're in this really fucked place in the media ecosystem where, like, you know, Viacom, Warner, all these companies, they abandoned a whole bunch of television to YouTube.
Yeah.
So that's where all the talent went. And you can make a living, but you cannot make the same budget of show as you used to. You cannot have the same infrastructure.
Right.
I used to have a 10-person writer's room, you know, of between writers and researchers, and we could have beautiful sets, and we could, you know, spend time to think about what we are doing. And now it's like me and a couple freelancers who are wonderful, talented people.
Yeah.
But because of this transition to YouTube, this is just what I harp on all the time, so sorry to launch into it, but because of this transition to YouTube, the sort of quality of all the media we're consuming has gone down. People used to spend money on this shit, you know?
And it was union stuff.
It was union work, right?
Yep.
But now you look at, like, look at the biggest comedy podcasters, right? 10 years ago, they would all be given talk shows, but now they're just on YouTube. The biggest comics, right? Andrew Schultz, right? Massive comic.
Yeah.
He's, you know, touring arenas, right? But what is the actual show he makes? It's this. It's him in front of a curtain with three guys going, "You see what Trump did?"
Right.
And that's it.
Right.
Whereas that used to be a guy like that 10 years ago would be Anthony Jeselnik getting the Jeselnik offensive, right? Or whatever.
Right.
There used to be infrastructure in comedy that led to being able to build a machine around a person, and now we're all just in basements with a couple of cameras, you know, paying some 25-year-old to like edit, you know, the thing and toss it up on YouTube.
Right.
And I think that's bad for comedy. That like the infrastructure has disappeared.
Well, it depends on who the person is. Like if there is a guy like say Andrew Schultz, nobody 10 years ago, 20 years ago, nobody was going to put money behind a guy that was saying the kind of things he was saying. So there is no gatekeeper now, and you do get access to different points of view, which I love. People go like, you know, like Joe Rogan is a very dear friend of mine. We started together. We literally lived in the same apartment. And how can you hang out with him? What do you mean? Like a guy who's like my brother? Like I think whatever, and not to say he's right wing, but he's contrarian. He skews right, I think more so than he used to, but a lot of people that are super right wing, Nick DiPaolo, like I love Nick DiPaolo, and he is like a Newsmax, but he's funny. And I think that as much as I think that the AOC voices belong out there, I think the far right voices belong out there. And I think that it used to be, I thought about this today, it used to be that particularly in Congress, that you had these two disparate, unfortunately not three, sides coming together with compromise and some kind of a balance. Mm-hmm. And now they're just two big weights. And instead of the scale going like this, the scale broke in the middle. And now there's just two heavy weights sitting on the table.
Yeah. Well, and you know, media fragmentation is a big part of that. The fact that, look, yes, gatekeepers going away, there are a lot of good things about that. But you know, the end of the sort of media monoculture, that was a compromise-inducing force, and there are a lot of very bad things about it. But we are also experiencing the bad things about media fragmentation now that, yeah, like there is no there's no Tim Russert on Sunday mornings going, okay, we got these sides, let's find the middle.
Right.
Not that the middle is always the best thing to find, but what you're talking about is that
well,
fragmentation.
You're getting
it's
not necessarily the middle, it's elements of each side coming together in a quilt pattern, which is the United States of America. That's what it's supposed to be. You know what I mean? It's supposed to be like, you know...
I don't think it's supposed to be anything.
Yeah, right.
You know, like it just is what it is.
Yeah.
And a lot of things about it fucking suck.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, there are ways that it can work better. But yes, the idea that we were brought up with about it was such that it would make a quote.
Do you think a show like that could exist today? Like a Tim Russert...
I mean, it currently does, just nobody watches it.
Who's doing that?
Who is the host of it? Meet the Press? I don't know. I mean, it's still
on
the air.
I mean, Bill Maher does, but I don't feel like he's getting real representation from both sides because they both are trying to echo Bill a little bit. Both sides want too hard to agree with what Bill Maher is saying. And I feel like they bend towards him a little bit.
That's funny. I've only been on Bill's show once and I had a great time. And I did admire because on the show...
Were you on the panel or he interviewed you?
I was on the panel. Okay. It was an interview / panel. Like I was on panel, but I got a little bit of focus is my memory of it. And I don't remember what he said, but he said something that was so stupid that all of the other panelists, including the right-wing guy, who I think was Charlie Sykes, who's like a center right guy. All of us were like, Bill, no. Yeah. And he's like, wah. Right. And I do think there's something admirable. And now this was like 6 or 7 years ago. There's something admirable about having on your own show space for people to call you an idiot.
Yes.
I think that's good. I don't know if he still does that. I haven't watched it a little bit.
Right.
But I do think that there's a role for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I used to write for him. I wrote for back when it was politically incorrect. It was my first writing job. And the problem is that show was every single night.
Damn.
So at a certain point, if you're...
The Comedy Central one?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I was a Comedy Central addict when I was a kid, but I was too young for that show. I wasn't that much in politics.
Right.
I was there to watch like Whose Line Is It Anyway in Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So, but anyway, he had to mine to get a hard opinion on things required him becoming a little more conspiratorial than he probably even is.
Mm.
And I think that kind of stuck with him, because if it was, you know, once a week, you can kind of have a restrained take on things and people are still happy to see you.
Yeah.
But if you want to be in their living rooms every night, you got to come up with some crazy shit.
Yeah. And that's also what's happening on YouTube, right? Like,
right.
I do that too. I do a weekly interview podcast called Factually. And then I do it's at this point, we've gotten enough sponsorships that we've been able to do it almost weekly, like 3 to 4 a month of these monologues that I do.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we talk about the news and I have a take. Sometimes we do pop culture and stuff like that too. But coming up with something new to say that often that you are interested in, that you can write jokes about, and that is like revelatory enough that people will click on it, it drains you fast. And I see why people just go like Russell Brand or whatever, or, you know, Tim Dillon, say outrageous things, you know, in order to keep people coming back. It's part of feeding the beast, you know?
Yeah.
Or you have an advantage if that's the way your brain already works.
Yes, if your brain works that way. And like Bill Burr has this beautiful, disarming ability to once in a while just stop and go, after a long rant, like, I don't believe half the shit myself. If you can be that guy and you can flip-flop with ease, then at least you're getting that there's entertainment value and you're not trying to be, you know, an arbiter of truth. But I think that the guys that, like, transition into being taken seriously get into real trouble.
That's my problem, is look, I care about a lot of stuff. I know a lot of stuff. I think I probably I investigate things in the real world a little bit more than a lot of comics, I would say. And so that's become my niche, is me talking about, hey, here's this real thing going on that you need to know about. Jokes on top of that, right? And sometimes it makes me a little uncomfortable because I'm like, I would rather just be fucking telling jokes.
Yeah.
And I do admire Bill's ability and a lot of comics' ability to hold what they say lightly.
Yeah.
And you know, whatever. And that's why people on the left and the right both like Bill, right?
Yeah.
Because like, well, this today I didn't like what he said, but I feel like if I talk to him, or whatever. And it's nice. It's like it's a good way to be as a person. Right. Even if it's not politically consistent.
Right.
It makes you more personable. And a lot of my shit is based on me finding here's what I think and like saying it. And then it makes you rigid in a way that pushes people away sometimes.
Yeah. I think being imperfect is there's something about being imperfect that people are attracted to. Also, to make a mistake and to admit it is something. Oh, speaking of which.
Yeah.
Should we talk about that?
Yeah, wow, that was a really good fucking segue. Because
was unconscious.
Was it unconscious?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I didn't plan to bring it up like that.
Really? I thought that you were just being incredibly slick. Genuinely?
No, I was, I really, like, wasn't.
Because I went, oh, wow, actually, we could talk about, and then you went, hey, hold on a second. I thought, oh, no, he planned it.
No.
But
as
you
I
actually
saying,
did. Wow.
Well, as I was saying it, it just clicked on me like, wait a minute, somebody just did that recently. And I was like, oh, you! You were the one that did it recently.
Well, and you've set me up good because you just made it sound like a good thing, like that I did it. Okay, well, let's talk about it.
It was a very good thing. You know, a lot of us have been in positions, like Joe Rogan, I think, did it pretty elegantly when there was the N-word tape that came out, and he took it face on, and he said, you know, that was a mistake of judgment. But he didn't try to say, well, the X, Y, and Z. And I think that just to set up what happened, there's a company, what is it called, Globe?
Called World.
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 And it does, it's a Bitcoin-based thing that reads your eye.
I want to hear you try to finish explaining it, and then I'll tell you what it is.
All right, it's a machine, and it scans your retina for identification purposes, and you were paid in Bitcoin, or in some type of a digital currency?
I was not personally paid in this currency.
You were offered the money.
They offered me real U.S. dollars my point. I was not paid ultimately. Yes, this is a company called World. They have a product called The Orb. They've been doing it since like 2022. Sam Altman is one of the co-founders. And their whole pitch is...
Is he the guy that designed OpenAI?
He's the OpenAI guy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so their whole pitch is, in the future, AI is going to take over, and so we'll need to know who's a human or not. And so this scans your iris, not your retina. Okay. Apparently, that's like a fingerprint type of thing where yeah. like everyone's iris is different, according to them. And then you go to the orb and you get scanned, and then it gives you like $40 in crypto when you get scanned.
Oh.
And that's part of what's really fucking weird about it, because they went to like a bunch of third world countries, developing countries, and like set up orb stations, and they like in like Brazil and stuff,
really?
and Indonesia, and they were giving out people $40 in crypto
yeah.
and like bribing local government officials to set this up and stuff. Which just a huge number of people are like, this is a horrible ethical thing to do, because you're basically creating a database of these people's irises. Now, they say that they don't save the iris data. They convert the iris data in some kind of cryptographic signature that is stored on your phone. So they, you know what I mean?
So it's like metadata.
It's like metadata. Exactly right. But still, there's plenty of privacy concerns about it. Anyway, they're launching in the U.S. They were like, do you want to come, you know, we'll pay you to come like make a video about it and to interview one of the people. I was like, I don't want to do the interview, but, you know, I was like, this company is bad. Right.
Yeah.
But I was like, this is such a ludicrous thing to ask me. They don't want a particular endorsement. They just want me to go do whatever.
Right.
I was like, let me go see what it is, right? And so I go make this video, very much toss it off, and it caused a firestorm on my social media, because I'm like on record. I've done multiple videos about how bad crypto is,
right.
About how bad AI is, right?
Right.
Or my criticisms of AI. I don't have criticisms of every single part
that
of AI.
It's unconstrained. Yeah,
I think the AI industry, I think a lot of it is just fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
I think like Sam Altman just goes and lies before Congress, or he tells a fairy story
yeah.
about like, you know, in the future, AI is going to be running everything. And so you need to do what I say and give me $500 billion. That's
basically the
scheme,
right?
They make a lot of big predictions when I don't think the technology is a lot more limited and has a lot more downsides than they say.
And there's a lot of false information in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There's a million ways that we could criticize
right.
it. Crypto, I think, is just like, it's historically just been a way to fleece people. You
right.
know, very few people have
done
anything.
It's a pyramid scheme.
Yeah, it's essentially a pyramid scheme. They're constantly trying to get new people in
but
order.
But it's not essentially. It is literally a
yes.
pyramid scheme. There
yes.
is no actual equity in it other than the belief that somebody else is going to buy it.
Yes. And there's no utility in it. Nobody's really using it
for
anything.
No, well, that's the
yeah.
thing I always say.
Yes.
Is everybody, when Bitcoin started, it had this idea that it was going to work as a currency in the third world so that people didn't have to deal with the swings of their currencies as fucking, you know, their government fell. And just the amount that the banks were making from changing currencies on international trade. None of that has happened.
No. No one's using it for anything.
Nobody's buying anything with a Bitcoin.
No, they're holding on to it. They're hodling.
Yeah.
They're holding on for dear life. They're going to stick with it forever. Or they're starting new coins so that they can like make some quick money and get out.
Right.
That's the whole industry. Ethereum is another one that was supposed to be used to like, you know, we'd like write programs on Ethereum. Like there'd be like code on the blockchain. Also hasn't happened.
Yeah.
Like, and it's really... And it's gone from a place where it was like a really central tech story to just being like a sideshow now, where
yeah.
it's still happening. People are still getting ripped off, but like nobody really thinks it's the future. Maybe if they, you know, Trump is like profiting massively from his own, you know, cryptocurrency right now.
Yeah.
Maybe they will get enough of a foothold in the U.S. government because of Trump that, you know, crypto will stick around longer than it would have otherwise.
Right.
But like, it's just people making their own money and saying, you should use my money. And then when you do, they take your money and then they leave. And that's
it. And they sell out.
And they sell out. And that's really all it's been. Part of the reason the orb is giving people crypto and like it, when you open the app, it's just a crypto wallet.
Yeah.
I think is an attempt to get more people to use crypto, right? Which benefits who? The people who are running the coin, which is World, right? So it's the same exact scheme. In any case, I go do this video because I'm like, honestly, it was seemed so stupid to me that they were asking me and really had no sense of what they wanted. They were just like, just come and do whatever.
Right.
That I was like, okay, I'll do this and I'll just like do such a half-assed job of the video that everyone will be able to tell, you know, that this is not something that I really believe in.
Right.
My audience fucking hated this, right? Because
So you were doing it ironically. A little bit.
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, look, it's not, it was a mistake on my part to do, because it's not really possible to do that kind of thing, ironically, right? Because I'm also, I'm not like an Eric Andre or a Tom Green or like someone who's going to show up and just be a fucking prick to them.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like I'm a polite person.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really within my power to go and be like, you know, here I am filming the video. Fuck you guys.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I was just sort of like, you know, these guys paid me to do this. All right, here it is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And
so you ended up not even taking the money.
Yes, I ended up. So this was like a week long firestorm on my on social media over me doing that. I mean, not that's not the biggest thing in the world, but you know, enough people hated it where I was like, this was very clearly a large mistake on my part. And yeah, so I put out a video talking about it. I turned down the money. I did not take the money from the company.
Yeah.
All they, you know, they ended up paying me for a flight to go up there and to the keynote, which is also what, like, you know, journalists did the same thing.
Right.
So I basically said, I'll just, I did not take the money, and I did like a 20-minute video in which I talked about my actual opinion of the project, which is what I wish I had done in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw it. It was great. The
thanks,
video
man.
Was great.
Thank you.
No, I thought it was very, unblinking. You leaned into it, you handled it.
Thank you.
And then you turned around and gave a pretty good explanation of what this is and why it's bad.
Yeah, because honestly, when I went to this keynote, it was like one of the weirdest experience, one of the weirdest gigs I've ever done.
Yeah.
You know, they had this like big hangar in San Francisco. The event was like open to the public because there weren't even that many people who were interested in it. Most of the people like applauding for the product launch were employees. They couldn't really explain what it was for or why the crypto was part of it. And so I left going like, man, this was like a, you know, it felt like a weird little corporate gig, right? You'd go do a corporate gig, you talk before some people who don't really know why you're there.
Right.
You make some easy money and you leave. I was thinking with that part of my brain. But when I left, I was like, this is one of the weirdest things I've ever been to. I would like to make a full video out of it, but I can't really because they paid me to be here. Once I decided, okay, I'm actually not going to take the money, then I was grateful because I was like, oh, now I get to actually like break down how fucked up this product is, how bizarre the launch is, and like what it says about the tech industry.
Do you feel like any of the kind of exposés you've done, or I don't know if you call it what you do an exposé, but sort of a, you know, an exposition about something, has it ever really harmed a company in a way that you felt good about?
Have you ever destroyed anyone's life in a way that you were happy about?
No, some of these companies need to be taken down.
Yeah.
Some of these, like, you know, business schemes that you talk about, you know.
Right.
I'm forgetting this one that I saw yours that I really liked. But like, you know, they need people like you. There needs to be somebody that's, you know, telling the emperor he's got no clothes on. So are there any in particular that you feel like you did some justice to?
You know, we did in the early years of Adam Ruins Everything, we did the diamond engagement ring story, which was the one that we were most famous for, where, you know, the diamond engagement ring was like made up by the De Beers Corporation in the 30s. People still come to my shows and go like, look, I got an emerald or whatever.
Right.
I got a lab grown diamond. I got a cubic zirconia, you know, because, you know, it was a lot cheaper and we got a trip to Europe instead, you know, or whatever. And that makes me really proud. Also in that same episode, we did one about Tom's Shoes, about the buy one, give one model.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Which is bullshit, and really harmful because these places don't need shoes, you know, they don't need a bunch of cheap ass American flip flops, you know?
Yeah.
And that model has really sort of fallen by the wayside, you know, so I'm not going to take responsibility for it, but, we did make a splash with that. I remember once, we did a story about how Luxottica owns almost every glasses brand. Most glasses brands are made by this one company, Luxottica, which also owns, I believe LensCrafters. It's been a couple of years, so hope I didn't get that wrong. But that video went really viral, and then Luxottica reached out and like tried to get Huffington Post to take down an article they wrote about our video. They didn't go after True TV because we, you know, we would have, it's fact checked and everything.
Yeah.
So they didn't really have a leg to stand up, but they tried to like bully Huffington Post about it.
Really?
So that made me happy that that got back to the corporate, you know, overlords at Luxottica. The funniest time this ever happened was, I made this show for Netflix called The G Word. We made it during the pandemic, came out in 2022.
What does G stand for?
Government. It's about the government. Okay. Made it about how the six episode miniseries about how the federal government works and all the good and bad things that it does.
Yeah.
Kind of.
That was miniseries. What do you call a series that you did that wasn't picked up for season
no,
two?
No, it was always a miniseries. It was always a miniseries. I mean,
I did a short film first. Well, they stopped funding halfway through production. Yeah, it's a short film.
No, this was a genuine miniseries. We had it wrapped up at the end. If it had been incredibly successful, would have, you know, we could have done another miniseries on a different topic, you know.
Right.
But it was like it did well enough, right? For like a Netflix docu series. At any rate, one of the segments we were doing was on the USDA and meat inspection, and we were trying to get into different meat plants, which are very hard to get into because they're all terrified of PETA and stuff. We eventually got into a Cargill beef processing plant, which was really cool. We were like the first film crew to get in one of these places in 20 years. I'm really proud of that segment. But the segment before that, we had been talking to the pork board, which are like the corporate pork people, about going into one of their plants. And I get on the phone with the pork board and they say, hey, so we don't really want to do this because do you remember this segment that you did on Adam Ruins Everything like 4 years ago? And I like flashed back in the phone call. Oh, yeah, we did a whole segment on how the craze for bacon. Do you remember the bacon craze of like epic bacon? Like everything tastes better with bacon. And suddenly pork belly was on all these fancy menus and stuff.
Okay.
That was like astroturfing by Big Pork, right? Big Pork was trying to offload. How do we sell all this bacon? They like invented the idea of pork belly as like a fancy food and stuff like that. And that's bad because like processed pork causes cancer and shit. You know, like there's a measurable amount of deaths that resulted from this. And so we did an expose on that. And so now here's 5 years later, they're like, yeah, you like said the pork board, you criticized the pork board. And now here you are asking for our help.
Yeah.
Like, do you understand why we might not want to do this?
Right.
And
well, if you think about it, what bigger lobbyist is there than pork? They
absolutely.
Literally call it pork in a bill.
It's literally pork. I was proud of my response though, because I said, like, look, I stand by everything that we said. It was all true.
Yeah.
It was all fact checked. It's also true that the USDA inspects the meat that you produce. So if you'd like to tell a different true story about your plants, I'd love
sure.
to work with you.
Right.
And they said thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah.
But it was like the rare example where something that I said like literally came and bit me on the ass. So
here's what I want to ask you.
Please.
Also, I'm realizing is you went to Bard College.
I did.
Says right here on my script, Bard College.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have a professor named Joel Covell? That was my wife's father. He taught communism sociology at Bard College.
I never had a class with him, but I remember his name because he was, I believe, there at the same time. Or if not,
yeah,
he
was.
Retired.
I think he was. Didn't get retired. He got forced out. He was. He had the Alger Hiss chair.
Yes.
And there was a big problem with the administration because he wrote a book that was very critical of the state of Israel.
Yeah.
And the board was very Jewish. It's a very Jewish school, I guess. And a lot of the. I
don't know if I agree with that.
Well, I think a lot of the their endowment is tied to. I don't know, but. He got fired for it, but he was really famous at the school for fighting against the administration.
I think this happened right before I was in there.
Yeah.
And I remember someone telling, I remember hearing a version of that story, and this is, you know, the more complimentary version of the institution, that like he was one of the sort of like older guard communists on that it used to be a much more just sort of like home for retired communists of a college.
Yeah.
And then they were getting more rigorous and they were just sort of like, all right, you're like the last one to go. Get out of here, you know? But I don't recall anything about like that particular book.
Yeah.
The president of the school a long time is Jewish, but is also a critic of the state of Israel. Like there's plenty of whatever.
Really?
I'm not trying to carry water for the school.
Yeah.
But I did hear about that controversy.
And then also my grandfather was in Steely Dan.
Your grandfather was in, okay. All right.
That was Bard College, right?
Steely Dan went to Bard College. Yeah. And there's also a longstanding, this is the dumbest one of all. Chevy Chase went to the school.
No.
As did one of the Beastie Boys. I think Youch went to Bard. I believe they're both dropouts. But the stupidest like music pop culture connection at Bard College is the rumor that there's the Bob Dylan lyric, "The pump don't work because the vandals stole the handles," right? Yeah. And people are like, that pump's on campus. there's a pump that someone stole the handle from on campus, and that's our pump. And you ask people, why does anybody think this? And there's no source. It's just a thing that people say. Because Dylan spent, you know, a summer in Woodstock or whatever, you know, like it's upstate New York,
sure.
Right? And he like had a motorcycle accident like not far from whatever,
right?
You know, is in that general area. But I love weird little liberal arts college lore.
I think Carol Leifer went there.
Really?
And I believe Paul Reiser might have gone there.
Oh, wow. I just heard Carol's interview with Marc Maron. It was incredible. Yeah,
she's great. She's great. Yeah, she's got a new book out.
Yes.
She was sitting in this
chair. She was in this chair?
Not long ago, yeah.
She's a legend.
Yeah, she's a legend.
Yeah.
So when you started, you didn't start in stand-up. You started like in sketch, right?
Yes, correct.
So what was that, a college sketch group?
Yeah, my college sketch group at Bard College, right?
They'd been around for years? No. And you guys started it?
No, we started it.
Oh, you did?
It was called Old English. My friend Ben Popick started the group, a couple of other friends of ours. And yeah, we started up and started making comedy at the school. We did live sketches and then also the DV video had just come out, which is, do you remember DV video? It was like it was tapes.
Yeah, little tapes.
Little cassette tapes, but it was digital. So,
right.
And Max had just added FireWire ports for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And so you could ingest the tapes and edit them on Final Cut Pro.
Yeah.
And so we made video sketches.
Amazing.
And like started, and then a couple years into it, started putting them on the internet.
Yeah.
And they started having success there. And then we all moved to New York. And some of us did. A lot of people got kicked out. It was the group started with like 15 people, and then one by one, people just got kicked out.
Really?
We were college students, right?
Yeah.
Just like the other people in the group didn't like them. Uh-huh. Like they were annoying.
Oh,
sometimes.
I think it was out of bar.
No, sorry. Kicked out of the group.
Kicked out of the group. Okay.
It was like, if any of them hear this, it was like shitty. Like we were being shitty to each other.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It was like group firing squad. It was like everyone would get together and be like, we're kicking
this
person out.
This is a feature film. You should fucking write this.
I had to go once to kick somebody out. But I wasn't the talker. I was just going for backup.
Yeah.
It was horrible. And at the end of this, I was one of like the last five people. And I was like, how did I not get kicked out?
Yeah.
Everybody hated me.
Yeah.
Like I was so annoying. I was on Adderall. I was manic all the time.
Uh-huh.
I was like a nerd. I couldn't hang. But I think it was because I was the one who taught everyone to use Final Cut Pro, how to edit. And I was the one who like set up the website because I knew how to code HTML and CSS and stuff like that. And so I think I got to stay in the group for that reason because I did all that work.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the ADD because I know your new special is about ADD and how you felt addicted to it. And you feel like, I think you said you were one of the first person diagnosed with it. You were, I guess, the first generation
It's probably like 1990, 1991. That wouldn't make me the first, but it was just starting to hit the cover of Time magazine. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like the first wave of it. Yeah,
right.
Before that,
it was just called hyperactivity disorder.
It was just like, that kid needs to be put in prison.
Yeah,
it was just, what the hell is wrong with that kid? I mean, I was really an acting out kid. I used to like bite the other kids at school and stuff like that and couldn't sit still. And, you know, yeah. So at the time it was like child psychiatrist and test you for ADD. Oh, this kid has ADD. And they medicated me and stuff like that.
With Adderall.
in the special, I say Adderall. In reality, it was Ritalin first and then Adderall. But, you know, you condense. You don't need
to.
They prescribed it to me, and I took it for a long time, and started taking it like under my own power in college, where I was like, okay, now I'm the one.
You mean so straight through though, from being a kid through college, you were on it?
I think I maybe took some breaks at some point, but I definitely did. But then in college, I was like, I want to go. I'm having trouble. Let me go get the diagnosis myself and get the meds myself. And then I took it for a number of years after that.
Do you think taking it at a young age consistently starts to rewire your brain permanently?
That's a good question. I mean, the research I know of is that the main effect that it has on kids when they take it young is it makes them shorter. Isn't that weird?
Really?
Like on average, it's like an inch or something. You're like, if you start taking it as a kid and you never stop, it does make you a little bit shorter. That's like as far as I know, that is the only like really firm physical effect that they know about. I think the main thing about it that we don't talk about often enough is that it's a stimulant, right? It is amphetamines. And
Hitler was on amphetamines and he was short. We figured it out.
Okay, that's too negative towards people who take Adderall. Because I want to be clear. Sometimes people misread my act. Yeah. I don't think it's bad to take Adderall. It didn't work for me.
Yes.
And I think that they should be more straight up and be like, you're giving the kid amphetamines.
Right.
You know?
Full disclosure, I was prescribed with ADHD when I was 40.
Wow.
I'm now 59.
Wow.
I've been taking Ritalin. For a while, I took it every day. For years, I took it every single day. And it helped me immensely. I got, you know, because I was writing on TV shows while trying to do stand-up on the weekends and raise two kids. And, you know, I wasn't able to function. And part of it is it worked as a stimulant, which I needed. But it also helped me focus on what I was doing at the time.
Mm.
Since then, I take it sort of as needed, you know, and it still works as needed. But the only way I can take it is I have to get up, take a walk, get a full stomach, take it. And then as I'm coming down at like 4 or 5 o'clock, go to the gym and work out really hard to avoid the crash.
The crash is the worst.
Yeah. Yeah. If I don't work out, I'm useless all night.
So I got long story short, I stopped taking it in my like mid to late 20s because I had like a really unhealthy lifestyle. You know, it would keep me up. I would have trouble sleeping. So I got in the habit of drinking every night to help me go to sleep. I was smoking like a chimney as well. And some of that's being in your 20s, but some of that was also just like I became addicted to all three things.
Right,
and
right.
I had to take down the Jenga tower, you know, or it was going to collapse. And so I quit smoking and Adderall in my 20s. It took an extra 10 years for me to quit drinking, which, you know, for me was very like I was addicted to drinking the way I was addicted to smoking, where I wasn't like a blackout drunk. I just like if I didn't have a drink, you know, every day, I'd be like jittery. You know what I mean?
So it was like you were medicating yourself.
I was medicating myself. And so I went, you know, sober on all that stuff.
Do you want more water, by the way?
I do want more water.
Can we grab him another water?
Thank you. I drank it so fast. Should we keep going or should we hold for the water?
No, keep
going.
Oh,
okay, great.
It's a very fluid show.
Oh, hell
literally.
Yeah. Wonderful. I love that. Now I have to pee. Can we do that on camera?
Yes, of course.
So
my highest rated podcast of all time.
Oh, the feeling of relief. That's the one thing I've never heard done on a podcast. I've never heard someone pee.
Oh, okay.
So thank you. Oh, another Pellegrino so that they know I'm fancy. Not a sponsorship. I only take sponsorships from evil tech companies. So I quit taking the Adderall, and you know, it was kind of like everything I've ever. Yeah, let's get rid of that.
It's a green screen, so we can't have a green bottle.
Oh, of course. Yeah. After I quit taking the Adderall, literally everything I've ever been I've ever been proud of in my life, I accomplished after that.
Really?
You know? Yeah, like it was after I stopped taking Adderall that I Started doing stand-up every night. You know, I really buckled down. And I was like, I'm going to become a stand-up comedian. This is in New York. Yeah. This is in my, this is like 26, 27 years old. I was like, I'm going to do open mics every single night. The sketch group had broken up. You know, we sort of ran as long as we could and went our separate ways. I was like, I want to keep doing comedy. Started doing stand-up every night. Eventually, you know, started, I got my first TV writing job. I got my first job at College Humor. I created Adam Ruins Everything. We did like, you know, five cycles of it, you know, made like 63 episodes of television, all that without the meds. And I was just like gunning myself, you know, I was just like pushing myself. Then during COVID, I was working on the Netflix show and I was like, I'm really, really having trouble focusing. It's really bothering me. And I went and got myself re-diagnosed. You know, I was like, you know what? I was diagnosed as a little kid in like 1991. I want to know if I still have it.
Right.
So I went to, I found a good place in LA that does diagnoses. They were like, oh, this is kind of weird. No one's ever done this before. No one's ever wanted the diagnosis again. But I was like, yeah, no, give it to me as though I'm an adult. At the end of all of it, they gave me like a big report on myself and shit. They said, yes, you do have ADD. You just, you cope well. You know, but you could take medication if you wanted to. And so I got a prescription for Vyvanse, which I cut a joke about Vyvanse in the special, but I want to do it now, which is that I used to snort Adderall in college because you just crush it up and you snort it. It hits you harder. It's college. Who's not going to try something like that? And I stopped doing it pretty quickly. It's like bad for you if you do that. Do not snort your Adderall.
No, don't snort your Adderall.
But Vyvanse, it is exactly the same as Adderall. The only difference is it's 10 times as expensive and you can't snort it. So they removed the feature and jacked up the price.
I tried Vyvanse once and my heart almost came out of my chest.
Really? You found it more powerful?
Everybody has a different reaction to different types of stimulants, but Vyvanse was the one that really hit me hard. But I went to get diagnosed when I said when I was 40. And I sat down with the therapist, who was a psychopharmacologist, and we started talking. And she said, and I didn't go in thinking I had ADHD. I just went in because I was on the edge of a nervous breakdown. I told you, I was doing all the shit.
Yeah.
And I sat on her couch, and we talked for about 10 minutes. And she goes, hold on, stop talking. She goes, your leg has been pumping up and down the entire time. You changed topics 6 times. You're telling me about how you can't finish one thing. You can't transition from one. She's like, you have ADHD, like classic, like I've never seen before.
Wow.
And I went on it, and it never made me feel jacked up. And she's like, that's what you'll... I go, how will I know if I have it? She's like, because when you take the medication, if you don't have it, you're going to be completely wired. And if you do, it's almost going to calm you down. And it totally calmed me down.
See, I have the opposite experience. I've heard many people say this, that it doesn't jack them up. For me, when I take it, and I have confirmed this again recently because I got the Vyvanse prescription, even when I take just a little bit of it, I feel so wired. I feel like I had like 10 cups of coffee.
Yeah.
And I feel like I have rocket shoes on for 3 hours.
Rocket shoes. That should have been the name of the special. Think of the fucking graphics you could have made.
Me looking like Sonic the Hedgehog. Then 3 hours later, I start crashing.
Yeah.
And I feel like I feel both exhausted and wired for the rest of the day. Then I can't sleep.
Yeah.
And then the next morning, I feel shot. I feel hungover the next day.
Right.
And I literally have tried taking the tiniest amount. Crazy thing about Vyvanse is the reason you can't snort it is because it only turns into the amphetamine when it combines with stomach acid. It's like a precursor drug.
Okay.
So like if you snort it, just nothing happens in your nose. It has to interact with your stomach acid. And that means that the pills, it's like a capsule with powder in it. And so what they told me is if you want to take less than the full amount, you open the pill, you put it in water, and then you drink some of the water. You drink like half of the water. And so I got a big...
Probably takes like shit, right?
It's like there's very little. Okay. There's almost nothing in it. But so I got a Nalgene, right? That's like a liter, right?
Uh-huh.
And I got down to where I'm drinking like a tenth of the Nalgene.
Uh-huh.
And it still has such a powerful effect
really?
On me. Yeah.
But you do it sometimes.
So about once every 6 months, I get frustrated.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is not in the special, but I used to have some jokes about it, but I was like, ah, it's too much to talk about. But once every 6 months or so, I'll get really frustrated. I have the bottle in my closet of like the last pill that I put in this water bottle. And I'll be like, all right, let me just try. And I'll take a little sip. And for 3 hours, I'll feel great. Get maybe slightly more done than I would have done otherwise. And then the rest of my day is shot.
So you just have to remind yourself sometimes why you don't take this.
Yeah. Like, I wish it worked for me. Yeah. I've talked to so many people who have said, like, oh, yeah, it really helped me. It changed everything for me. And for me, it just didn't. And I honestly wonder if even when I was taking it in college, like, did it work for me? Because most of my memories were of not sleeping, being really manic around my friends, smoking like a chimney, you know, like drinking, a quarter of a bottle of Jack to go to sleep, you know, and just like I looked like shit.
Yeah.
When I look at photos or footage of myself from those days, I'm like, oh my God, you know.
Yeah, you look better now.
Thank you.
You do. You used to be kind of round. You had like a round head.
I mean, that's so spot on. That's how I think of it too. Yeah. I had sort of a much more egg-shaped head.
All right.
That was when I was drinking. When I look at Adam Ruins Everything, I quit drinking before the final year of the show.
Right.
And when I look back at the next to the final year, I'm like, I can tell. If you show me a random clip of the show, I can tell you whether or not I was drinking.
No, because you're a handsome guy now.
Thank you. I also started working out with a trainer. Oh, okay. So that helped.
Do you find now, are you married?
Mm-mm,
do you find that women have, you've seen a difference in the way women react to you now?
Yes, but I also recently left a 15-year relationship, and so they treat me a lot differently.
She was 15 years old.
Oh, my God.
No wonder you left. She was getting too old.
That's incredible. that was incredible. I'm single again for the first time in a long time.
How's that feel?
It feels good. It was what we both needed. It was what I needed. It was good.
It's what you needed.
It was a very, very happy relationship. And then we realized we both needed to explore other things. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You're an explorer now.
Yeah.
You get on the apps or how you meet?
Yeah,
them?
I'm on the apps. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Are you on the one? What is it? Bumble, where the woman picks you?
No, the only app I'm on is Field. Do you know Field?
Field. No.
Field is the there's a lot of queer people on Field. There's a lot of kink on Field. There's a lot of poly people on. It's just like the app for weirdos.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Are you kinky or something?
I was in a relationship for a very long time. I'm like. Trying to, I'm like, I want to see the other side of life.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because I don't want to join Hinge and Bumble. These are all going to be full of people who are like looking for their soulmates,
right,
you know?
Right.
And I'm sort of been there, done that.
You
right?
just want to get whipped and humiliated or something.
I want to see. I want to see the how many colors are on God's palette. You know.
Right.
I want to explore the far corners of the buffet of life.
Will you talk about these experiences on your podcast as you explore?
I've not talked about it on my podcast. I am talking about them on stage.
Yeah.
That like my whole act now is like I sort of open with like 10 minutes of politics and then I'm just talking about this stuff. And I really enjoy talking about it because most of my career has been me talking about information and comedy. And
no, I remember reading that about you talking about your special that you wanted to do something more personal.
Yep. But even that was like, it's ADD. It's like, it's sort of very cerebral, right?
Yeah.
And now I'm talking about sex, you know, I'm talking about fucking and I really enjoy it.
Have you been with transsexuals yet?
I have actually, yeah.
That's amazing. I think if I was single, I would try that.
Yeah, it's a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful people. I mean, as is everybody. I'm like, I'm not trying to draw a distinction. But
no,
like, last time I was single, the number of people who are, you know, some form of queer now is complete, like... I notice it most when I go back to New York, right? Because I was in New York, I was in the comedy scene, right? I was in my 20s, and, you know, the weirdest anybody got, the freakiest anybody got was, like, being a hipster in Williamsburg.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? It was like having mutton chops or something.
Yeah.
And now people are just, like,
Jim Norton just married a trans woman.
Did he really?
Yeah, they're very happily married. They've been together forever. And
wonderful.
Yeah, no, and a lot of people have talked about, I had a near-gay experience that I wrote about in my book and I talked about on the Howard Stern Show. And I really feel like our kids, because I have kids.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, oh, every kid's gay now. It's like, no, we always were. Yeah. There was always a spectrum that people lived on. Yep. They're actually just honoring it.
Yep. And you know what a big part of my act is about is it's people experimenting. It's people trying things and seeing what they like, especially in their 20s. It's the right time to do it, you know? And, you know, whatever, queerness is like something that I think everybody can enter into to some amount, you know, to the extent that they want to explore it. But women are so much better at this than men.
Yeah.
You know, women like just trying new things and labeling themselves as like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm whatever. I'm a little bi or whatever it is.
Right.
But I think we're finally making some progress with I don't know, men trying new things, perhaps. In society.
Yeah, I always wondered, like, if I said, can I be with a trans person? Mm-hmm. I thought, because I've been married 25 years, and I've been with her for 28. So I haven't been an explorer in a very long time.
Yeah.
I am like when you see one of the astronauts that walked on the moon. Like, that's what I feel like now.
But wait, you haven't walked
John
on the moon.
Glenn.
You haven't walked on the moon. What do you mean?
I mean, since I've even been exploring, since even the idea of me going into the woods in Boston one night at 3 a.m. when I was shit-faced to suck a dick, like, that was so far long ago.
Yeah.
That's when I planted my flag.
I see. Yeah. You're a retired astronaut.
I'm a retired astronaut.
You're like, I remember when I was exploring.
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
I gotcha.
And I really did feel like the only thing that kept me from having a gay experience was the right guy pulling his dick out in front of me.
That's what I talk about in my act, man. That's how
really?
I was felt as well, yeah.
No
yeah.
shit.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the thing is with I feel like you can get this thing built up in your head where it's going to be some big deal,
yeah.
you know, and it's just another person, you right. know what I mean? And right. you just have a reaction or not, you know, and it's not like a big reaction, like, oh, are you horny still? Then
right.
then you'll have a nice time.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
And if you're and if you're not, then you say, hey, you know, hey, it was nice hanging out, nice spending time with you, or whatever, right? It's like it doesn't need to be such a big fucking deal. You know
so
what I mean?
We have these
conceptions of ourselves, you
right.
know, as straight or gay. I actually used to do a joke about how people consider themselves like either an alcoholic or a moderate drinker,
uh-huh.
right? Where like if you're an alcoholic, you got to go sit in that sad basement and drink coffee out of tiny cups. But if you're a moderate drinker, you can drink as much as you want at any time because you're not one of those sad people.
Right.
Whereas really, I realized I was not an alcoholic. I was just addicted to alcohol,
yeah.
right? And there's a lot of people who are addicted to alcohol don't self-label as alcoholics.
Right.
I think it's the same thing with this stuff. A lot of people are like, I'm straight. Well, why are you so sure of this?
Yeah, right.
You know, like, what if you give it a little try, man, you know?
Did you ever have a moment after a new sexual experience,
mm-hmm.
a new type of, where you felt afterwards any shame or confusion or regret, or was it always just, all right, I tried that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I've had shame after sexual. I think the only time that I've ever felt shame after a sexual experience was when I pushed myself to do something I wasn't comfortable with,
right.
and that has nothing to do with the type of person. That's happened with you know, just straight cis women with me, where I'm just like, oh, I was not that into the person,
right.
but I was like trying to do a good job or
right,
something like that.
Right.
You know, that also used to happen to me in my 20s too. Because I think that's the performer in me, right? Where I'm like, oh, I want to do well with the crowd.
That's
you
so
know?
Interesting.
I'm here on the date with the person. They're into me,
yeah.
right? They're being very nice. They've done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
They're a perfectly attractive person.
Uh-huh.
You know, well, shouldn't I be able to give them a good experience
yeah.
for both of us?
Yeah, yeah.
Shouldn't I do a good job on the date? And shouldn't a good date lead to, you know, lead to more things happening,
yeah.
leading back to going back to someone's place and having a good time. And so then I'll follow through on that. And then the end, but actually I wasn't really feeling it. You
and
know?
You're having sex and you're like, I got to close strong here. I need a good closing bit here. I mean, I can remember going down on a girl just to prove a point until my tongue ached. And I was like, what am I doing? I'm not even into this. I'm just trying to, you know, get a good Yelp review.
Well, look, if you're trying to make someone else come, that is something that you can just do that generously.
Yes,
you know?
That's
and
true.
You can say, you know what,
that's
I'm going to take one for the team.
Yep.
And that's altruistic.
Right.
But in terms of just, but you should still have a genuine, like, attraction to the person and desire to be there in that moment. You shouldn't be, you know, fundamentally taking one for the team and
or just doing it because I mean, there's a lot of sexual addiction. People talk about alcohol and stuff, but the amount of men, like, I have friends that, like, we walk down the street, they can't not check out and comment, like, every woman. And they, you know, go out with women that I go, like, dude, she's not even in your fucking world. Like, she, first of all, too young.
Yeah.
Nothing in common with her.
Yeah.
You know, like, dumb. You're smart. She's dumb. Yeah. Like, what are you doing? This is only for your physical pleasure.
And you know what? I'm going to draw a comparison here because I think that, so I think men have a lot of trouble turning down sex, right? Yeah. We are socialized to, we're told that to be a man is to want to fuck all the time.
Right.
And therefore, it is not actually okay for you to not be in the mood at any particular moment, right?
Yeah.
And I think that leads to what you're talking about. Whereas, like, if someone, you know, if someone's available, hey, I gotta take you up on that. You know what I mean? And that's, I think, some of the pressure I've put on myself. Well, why would I say no to this nice person who wants to fuck me, right? Like, isn't that what I'm here to do? And then afterwards, I go, oh no, actually, I didn't want to, and I couldn't admit to myself I didn't want to. Mm. It's the same thing with that orb gig. You know what it was? Part of it was like,
good transition.
Was they're offering me money, right?
Yep.
It's easy money to do something. I'm like, this doesn't fucking matter. Well, it would be wrong somehow to turn it down, right?
Yeah.
And that was a mistake, right? Even though, again, I tried to sort of wink at it and like do it. Yeah, I was, you know, well, everyone will know I'm not into this, right?
Yeah.
It was like the right thing to do would have been said, no, this is obviously wrong.
No, I did an ad once. I had a very similar experience. I did an ad for Kratom. I don't know if you know anything about Kratom, but
yeah,
it's basically an opiate. And they sent me some free samples. It's like, it's pills, and I don't know what the chemical makeup is. They say it's like from the fucking, you know, Peruvian jungles, and it's all organic.
Yeah.
It's opium. And so, so I took it and I was knocked out, and I did the ad and I shouldn't have. And then I got all these emails from people going like, my cousin committed suicide from withdrawal on that shit. Like, and I looked it up on the internet. I was like, horror stories about this stuff, Kratom.
Yeah.
And I apologized to people that I had endorsed it.
Yeah.
And it, but I knew I took it. And knew that there was something fucked up about it. And I still did the ad. And it wasn't until I got the emails that I went, oh, yeah, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
And so I called my agent. I go, look, not only are I not doing it, you should not be sending this to your other clients. This is bad. Have you heard of Kratom?
I have heard of it. Yeah,
you can buy it at head shops now.
Yeah, you see like signs up for it, like stapled to lampposts and stuff.
Yeah,
like it's weird. Right. And it's one of those things where it's like, it's legal, but not
Only because the FDA hasn't done the testing on it yet. It will be. It will be illegal.
Yeah, it might be one of those things where the where the drug is so fucked up, the market isn't even that big. You know, where like no one's really like. Do you know a salvia?
Yeah,
that stuff where you like just like trip out for like 30 seconds.
Yeah,
where like not that many people really want to do that.
I think that's like a seed, though.
Yeah, is I don't know that much about it. I just remember like the
don't
really.
Don't you listen to every Joe Rogan episode?
the really big stoners I knew in college would do salvia and then be like, don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't. I didn't have a good time.
They say you lose your the distinction between your consciousness and your unconsciousness, and you just float, which I think with most psychedelics, that's the goal to some degree, like psilocybin. You step back from yourself, which is why they often prescribe it for people with terminal illnesses, because you can shrink down your mortality and observe it in a way that lets you accept it.
Yeah.
Which is, but you don't want to detach from it. You just want to shrink it down.
Yeah.
And salvia, you detach.
Yeah. You really like lose your ego or whatever.
Yeah. That's
really
what it is. They lose your ego.
Difficult way. Yeah.
Yeah. And then how are you going to live in Hollywood with no ego? Jesus.
Well, why would you even do anything?
Right.
Well, something I've been thinking about is it's easy to force yourself to do stuff that you don't really want to do, you know? That's something I'm trying to pay attention to more. It's a weirdly hard thing to only do things that you really want to do. Does that make sense? Like, there's a lot of times where a classic example of this is like, I'm scrolling on my phone. I feel bad about it. I don't like it. I'm not enjoying it. I know that if I were to read a book or even play a video game, I would enjoy that more. Yeah. And yet, for some reason, I'm doing the thing I enjoy less.
Right, right.
And it's easy to do that.
I go to bed with a book in my hand.
Yeah.
And I know I've got a half hour before I'm turning the lights out.
And wouldn't it feel so good to read it? I feel really good.
And then I fucking look at my phone for, and not a half hour, an hour.
Right,
and
exactly.
And you go like, what the fuck am I doing? I would have loved, instead of feeling, if I read a book, I just finished a great book by Alice Rooney. You ever read Alice Rooney at all? She's an Irish author.
And Sally Rooney?
Sally Rooney, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Also haven't read her, but yeah. I apparently know more about her than you do.
I don't even know the name of the book. I swear to God, if with a gun to my head, she wrote Normal People.
Normal People Hulu one, right?
Yeah. But anyway, like I read it and I feel restored. I feel like reading is every definition of meditation is
right.
You're taking your mind off something and you're focusing on something else.
Yep.
And that's how I feel after I read. I feel like I just meditated.
Yep.
And then I look at my phone and I feel empty. I feel crashed out.
Right.
My eyes hurt. It's amazing. And then, like you said, you make that choice or you don't make that choice is a better way of describing it.
And I think it's because when you're on your phone, to me, the feeling is you always feel like you're not really on your phone. You're just on it for a second before you go do something else.
Right.
So it feels like it's not time spent at all.
Yeah.
You're like, and I remember when I first got the phone, that was the feeling. Oh, all those little moments when I'm bored, I'm waiting in the line at the grocery store, that little moment, now I can entertain myself. But it's not really that. It's, you know, now you're lying in bed for 90 minutes before you get up and make coffee because you're too busy looking at all the shit, you know?
Right.
You know what I did a couple weeks ago was I deleted everything from my phone that is, pulled to refresh. I deleted all the news apps. I deleted all of Instagram, Blue Sky, Twitter.
Really?
They're all off my phone. And I've mostly blocked them on my laptop as well.
Wow.
I have a social assistant who posts my stuff because I have too much stuff to post myself, like too many clips and things. And so I told her, just start sending me like a digest, like once a day, once every couple days of like what the activity is. So I see what the responses are to things.
Yeah.
And send me a screenshot of like my messages. So I see if there's a message I want to actually go through the trouble logging in and replying to. But that's been pretty good. It's been helpful to do that.
So that must have been a big phone call whenever this thing happened with World or Globe or whatever it's called.
There's a lot going on. Yeah.
Little activity, Adam. You may want to start refreshing again.
There's a point at which you realize that, like, you're better off just not reading your own mentions.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
I, as a rule, do not go on Reddit. I never go, because that, to me, is the most toxic place for conversations about people.
Absolutely.
It's just a pile-on.
Well, because the tone of Reddit is, let me just finish the thing I was going to say, and then I'll start ragging on Reddit, because that'll be an extra 10 minutes. Now that I've deleted all this stuff from my phone, what I do is, when I go to the bathroom, I pull my phone out, and I just look at the icons, and I go, there's nothing here for me while I'm taking a shit. And I just stare at, like, emails. No, there's no new emails. I know that because I'm up to date on my emails.
Yeah.
And, like, that's it, you know, and there's nothing to look at. I still have the reflex, but at least I'm not engaging with the bullshit. Reddit, the problem is that the tone of Reddit, for some reason, as opposed to every other social media site, the tone of Reddit is, like, this pleases me.
This displeases me.
Oh, yes. Look at every comment. The tone of every comment is, I know more about this than anybody else.
Yeah.
And you know what in my expert opinion is. And so when something comes up about me, right, someone posts one of my videos, people would be like, oh, Adam Conover, I haven't seen what he's done in 10 years, but I always thought that he was like this or like that. Like, and everyone's like, yes, I think that too.
Yeah.
Like, it's like this weird little, like there's some like court of you know, nobles like staring down at a parade that's going by. Oh, what do I think of the internet today?
And it's based on a thumbnail that they remember. It's based on a headline. It's not based. Here you are putting out a 30-minute, well thought out video piece that's, you know, you researched and all that stuff. And what you're getting is, 10 years ago, I had this thought.
Yep.
So I'll put it down here.
And here's the worst part about it, that this is my constant. maybe this is the thing I would have done differently in my career. I'm not sure. You tell me what you think. When I created Adam Ruins Everything, I was leaning on my background as a sketch writer and a TV writer rather than as a stand-up comic. You know, I was not really established as a comic at the time. I was doing I was doing 15-minute sets around town like a lot of people, and occasionally I was doing a college or a weekend, right? But so I wanted it to be really funny. The whole comedic premise of it was that I played a character version of myself who's really annoying, right? Mm-hmm. So my character was, someone would say something and my character would go, well, actually, and all the other characters would go, oh my God, this guy again. That was the comedic engine of the whole thing, was that my character is annoying. The point being, yes, it's annoying to say these things, so let's heighten that by having the character be annoying. Basically, I'm Steve Urkel, but myself, right? There are many, many people who think that is literally me. And so they post on the internet, oh, Adam Conover? I always thought that guy was so annoying.
Right.
I thought he had the most punchable face.
Yeah.
He's the human well actually guy. Oh, he's like if a Redditor was a person, because he's always going well actually. And I'm like, yeah, that was the fucking joke. I'm not like that in real life. That was, the last episode of that came out in 2019.
Right.
I'm a different person, but they don't. It's like they saw the joke happen, but they did not realize it was funny.
Yeah. No context.
Which is a bizarre problem. But I think this is one of the things about comedy, is that this is why the it's just a joke defense doesn't really work that well for comedy. Because no matter when you tell a joke, 5% of the audience is going to think it's literally true.
Yeah.
No matter what. No matter how silly your joke is.
How did you react to Andrew Dice Clay when he was around in the late 80s?
I think I was too busy watching, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Greg.
So
I was a child.
You didn't have a judgment of Andrew back then.
I was 6 years old. I mean, I don't know. What do you feel the context of his act was? I've heard it since, but I don't really know how it landed at the time.
Well, it's funny because I'm a comic and I should have been more open to it. But when I heard Andrew Dice Clay when I was in my 20s, I was like, this guy's a fucking pig, the things he's saying. And now I listen to, he's got this album called The Day the Laughter
I've heard
Laughter
this, The
Died.
Day the Laughter Died, where he's bombing
he
in
bombs.
A basement.
Yeah. In like a shit club in Brooklyn called Pips. At 11 o'clock at night, he has already done Madison Square Garden, and he drops into this club that has 50 people in it, unannounced at 11 o'clock at night, and just bombs.
Wow.
But he never flinches.
Mm-hmm.
You never see him go well, that one didn't work, or hey, you guys seem like you're having a bad, he just locked in, and he did. And to me, it made me go oh, right, that's who this guy is. He's the guy that stands behind shit that you can't stand behind. It's completely a persona. And now I think he's kind of a genius, And do I think that his followers saw this? 90% of them were taking it at face value and were going to see a guy say horrible stuff about women.
Look, both things are true, right? Both things are true. When you say something in comedy that's is it satire or is it real, right?
Yeah.
It's always both, and that's what we have to remember. One of my favorite things, if you let me tell you a story, this is one of my favorite comedy clips I've ever seen. So there's this famous interview where Ricky Gervais interviews Gary Shandling. Have you ever seen this?
No.
So Ricky Gervais, this was right after the first Office. I think he was making Extras at the time.
Okay.
That was the name of the show, right?
Yeah.
And so he is doing some kind of interview show. He shows up at Gary Shandling's house with a camera to interview him. And Gary Shandling's his comedic idol because he loves the Larry Sanders Show and stuff. Gary Shandling's one of my number one horrible human being in many ways. Incredible comic. And the Larry Sanders Show is my favorite thing ever. So Gervais, Gervais shows up in this. For some reason, there was a miscommunication. Shandling doesn't know he's coming that day, and so he's pissed off. And so Shandling is being so cutting and mean to Gervais, and Gervais is laughing nervously. It's incredible to watch. But there's this part halfway through where Shandling says, hey, I watched some of those jokes that you did about Jewish people. I don't think you like Jewish people very much. And Gervais goes, oh, no, it's satire. It's about, it's sort of funny when someone says something, there's a misunderstanding and it seems a little racist, but it's not really. And it's about, oh, isn't that a funny situation, right? And they actually show some clips of this, of the kind of classic Ricky Gervais comedy where a white person or a white man says something that's accidentally racist in quotation marks, and then there's a Jewish person or a black person or a woman who goes like, oh, what? What did you mean? And then you go, oh, sorry. Oops, oops.
Yeah.
Like a little awkward that I accidentally said something that could be a little racist,
yeah.
right? And so it cuts back to Shandling and he says, yeah, I know that you think that you're doing that satirically, but when I watch you do it, I see that you're just excited to say the slur.
Uh-huh.
You're just excited that you get to say something racist.
Right.
I think there's a little boy inside of you who's just excited to say it.
Uh-huh.
And Gervais has no reply to this. He just sort of laughs. And watching this now, I'm like, yeah, that's how I feel about that comedy. Mm-hmm. When I watch, you know, that sort of like mid-2000s, edgy indie, it was really cool at the time, right?
Right.
It's like pushing at boundaries a little bit of like, oh, it's about racism.
Yeah.
You know, Sarah Silverman used to do a lot of stuff like this before
yep.
that. I won't talk about her act because she's talked about it plenty,
yeah.
what she thinks about it now. When I go back and watch it, I'm like, yeah, sure, it's ironic. It's in these layers and everything. But at the end of the day, yeah, you're just saying the slur. You're just saying the racist thing. And that's part of the fun.
Right.
It is part of the fun, and part of the audience is watching it because
right,
that's part
right,
of the fun.
Right.
That's part of why everyone is enjoying it. And like, you have to accept that. And
yes.
what's really cool is that Shandling saw through that. This video this was recorded in like 2003 or something like that, and was like 20 years ahead of everybody else on. Because I think when you go back watch that stuff now, it's a little bit like retrograde to me anyway. That's
yeah.
how I feel about it.
No, I feel like it's to this day because I was that generation of comic and I saw Louis doing that stuff and even Zach Galifianakis. There was a lot of people that were demanding that you take in the room, that we're a bunch of educated, left-leaning people. So
yep.
when I say it here, it's okay. But then I remember, I'm not going to say which person this was, but they were on stage. And they have a joke where they say the N-word. Because back then, comics said the N-word. I did.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't.
I did, too. I had a joke very early on
yeah.
where I did. And it was about, the joke was about the N-word.
Exactly.
And then
I
another comic,
never,
thank God, said, don't say, man, that's don't do
well,
that.
Well, I always said I never used it. I've said it. I've used it in describing the word itself. I've
exactly
used it
right.
in what, again, air quotes, intellectually I was using it.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's on tape and that's been played on the internet. And it's not good. But but to this day, there are bits that I do that play with that line still.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that. But then sometimes I realize, oh, I'm leaning too heavily into that. I am the little boy who's got the who's playing with the knife, you know, going like,
yeah.
oh, look at me, you know. So
I think what it requires is humility, right? Because like, sure, maybe in a couple decades you'll look back at what you're doing now and saying, oh man, I wouldn't tell that joke today,
right.
but it's working right now. Just like whatever Galifianakis was doing or whatever Louis was doing or Sarah. And I'm not going to fault them that crazily because it was working at the time. But what you're talking about, that understanding of like, hey, we're all well-educated, left-leaning people who all, none of us are racist.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we can tell the joke.
Right.
Is like now we're like, yeah, that's fucking smug.
Yeah.
That's sure full of yourself to think that you're above suspicion.
Right.
And I used to have jokes like that too, where it's premised on, no, I'm a good person though.
Right.
So clearly when I do it, it's ironic. Again, this is the same fucking problem I did with the orb thing. Cause I was like, no, everyone knows I'm an anti-scam.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
I can
right.
do the thing cause everyone knows I won't mean it. No,
right.
to participate in it is to do it. And that's what you learn.
And there's going to be some people that see you do it that don't get the context and may
right.
buy that product.
Right.
right.
I think in this case, very unlikely because the product is like essentially fake and barely
yeah.
exists. But yes, that's the problem. And so I think having some humility about being like, hey, maybe I'm not as fucking clever as I think
mm-hmm.
I am. And maybe I shouldn't be so far out on a limb all the time,
right.
you know, is a better way to be.
Well, my whole thing is I should be able to do my act no matter what. I could be in Dallas, Texas
there
in front
go.
Of a bunch of MAGA people. I could be at a black comedy show, you know, at the Improv on a Monday night or whatever. And I should be able to do the same. My persona and my material should be so strong that you get it no matter what. It shouldn't rely on the room getting it.
Yep. Yep.
So, all right, it's time for Fastballs with Fitz.
Thumbs up. Let's do it. Was there supposed to be a song that played? Did it play and I missed it? Do you insert it later?
Let's put a song in. What's the closest you ever got to a fist fight on stage?
The closest I ever got to a fist fight on stage. I don't think I have ever had one. The weirdest thing that ever happened to me on stage was I was doing a bunch of material about how I quit drinking. Basically the same premise I told you earlier that, I think a lot of people are addicted who don't realize that they are. And someone in the audience started shouting, "Are you Carrie Nation? Are you Carrie Nation?" And I was like, "What?" And they had to be kicked out. This is at like a theater in Portland, I think. And Carrie Nation, I found out later, is like the name of a famous prohibitionist who would like destroy bottles of liquor with an axe. And this person like freaked out. They freaked out that I was criticizing drinking. From the 30s, yeah.
It was a 100-year-old grudge they had?
Yeah, it was really weird. And this person, like, lost it and was screaming. Wow. This was not a heckler. This was someone who I think people in the area were disturbed by this person.
Are you a robber baron?
Yeah. It's not quite a fist fight, but...
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
There are two types of people in the world. Go.
Oh, man, I want to have a good one. I think it's still and sparkling.
It's tap and sparkling.
Sparkling?
Yeah.
No, well, people who want bottled still at a restaurant, no.
No.
Insane. Tap and sparkling.
Tap and sparkling. I can see that. Yeah. Okay. Have you ever not finished a set on stage?
Yes. You know what? When you asked me my fist fight, the incident I thought about is a different incident.
Okay.
And it's a little bit of a story if you want to hear it. This is one of my biggest moments of humiliation early starting up as in comedy. So Caroline's used to have a March Madness where, you know, it was like 100 comics and then they'd do a bracket, right? And you'd go head to head, you'd be on stage next to each other, right? And so I was doing I was on stage with Chris DiStefano, and I was doing this bit where I was my big closer at the time. This was when I literally had like 7 minutes total. So I like had to do this closer, right?
Yeah.
And it was based on the Raffi song that goes, "If you wake up in the morning, it's 12:45, and you wanna have a little fun, you brush your teeth." So my joke was like, it keeps going. You wake up in the morning, it's 1:45. Wake up in the morning, it's 2:45. My joke is like, what the fuck is the problem with your teeth? You have OCD, right? And so I'd go through all the way to 5, right? But they would do an air horn when you hit the end of your set, right?
Yeah.
When you ran out of time. And so they interrupted me at 3.
Oh,
right?
No.
DiStefano's next. He goes, "Hey, I want to hear the end of the joke. Don't you?" And the crowd's like, "Yay!" And the judges are like, "All right, you can do the end of your joke." So I go, "If you wake up in the morning, it's 3:45," and I do that punchline, right? And then I get a big laugh, and then I go, "If you wake up in the morning, it's 4:45," which was supposed to be the blow of the whole thing, right? But DiStefano goes, "Hold on a second." And the crowd's like, "Whoa!" And now it looks like I'm biting off more, like I'm trying to take too much time. And the crowd's like, "No." I should have stopped at 4. I could have stopped at 4. It was like fundamentally my mistake.
Yeah, you missed your exit.
I missed my exit.
Yeah.
And like, it was like a big rookie mistake that afterwards I was like, and this is the kind of show where it's like all the comics are watching too. So it was like, it felt like rank humiliation. I was like, I'm never going to live this down. No one gave a shit. But like in my just getting started, stand up head.
Oh, you did sleep nights with that one.
Yeah. I was, oh God,
yeah.
I've destroyed everything. Ugh. Yeah.
All right. Last thing I'll ask you. When's the last time that you apologized? That's literally on my script.
I just put out a video on Friday where I apologized for the sponsorship.
His podcast it's a great podcast. It's called...
Damn, you're a big fan.
Hold on. No, Factually.
Thank you.
It's called Factually. It used to be called Adam Ruins Everything, and then it transitioned into being...
Correct. It was the Adam Ruins Everything, the podcast, and
then
we transitioned it to Factually, yeah.
The new special is... fantastic.
Thank you, man.
What else?
It's called Unmedicated. You can get it on Dropout.
Yeah, on Dropout.
Yeah.
And you get some tour dates coming up. Oklahoma City, 9/12. The day after 9/11, you're going to be in a home of terrorism like Oklahoma City? That's insane. Tulsa, Oklahoma, September 14th, if he makes it. Brea on September 21st, and he's coming to Tacoma, Spokane. Go to adamconover.net.
And we're doing a big announcement of a bunch of new tour dates in like a couple weeks. So
I'm
doing a fall tour, but we got to, like, those are the only ones that have been announced yet. But in like a couple weeks, you know, I'm like talking to my agent. He's like, okay, we're going to do a big announcement. Can't we just announce them now? No, we got to do it all on the same day. Yeah. So I'm going to a bunch of other cities as well. I'm going to be in like, I'm going to be all over the country. So go to adamconover.net for tickets in a couple weeks.
I've seen your stand up recently a couple times and you're on fire.
Thank you.
You're really, really funny. And, you know, I can't imagine people not coming out to see you, but they're going to be surprised because I think a lot of people probably know you for your podcast, your TV show. They're going to be very happy when they see your stand-up.
They're
going
to be happy to hear about all my strange sexual experiences.
God, I really, that's a second podcast. We're going to have to bring you back for some field,
I love that we got into that. This is the first podcast I talked about that
stuff.
All right,
good.
So thank you.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
All right, thank you, Adam.
Dude.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Devin Whitmire. People from South Carolina, like myself, are proud of their state, but even we don't know every nook and cranny or every piece of culture or history. To explore places that are off the beaten path, you have to talk to the people there because their stories, their ideas make everything come together. From Discover South Carolina, it's the Palmetto Porch. To learn more, visit scpalmettoporch.com.